Good morning. Please be seated. The first case on our calendar this morning is Carter v. Andrews, case number 66237. Ms. Goldberg, you ready to proceed? Okay. Hi. Who's with you at council table today?
Matthew Holland.
Mr. Holland.
May I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Of course.
Thank you. Your Honor?
One moment. Would somebody mind closing the doors to the hallway? Thank you very much. It's a distraction to the council and to the court, too. So we want to give you our utmost attention.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, go ahead.
This case involves a motor vehicle accident where defendant Guy Andrews hit appellant Charles Carter and immediately fled from the scene and concealed his identity for months after the accident. It would be an injustice to Charles Carter to affirm the lower court's decision when the plaintiff named the defendant throughout the body of the complaint, clearly intended to state cause of action of negligence and negligence per se against Guy Andrews, as well as substantially comply with DMV service of process by serving a copy of process at the DMV, as well as paying the $5 fee. In this set of circumstances, Guy Andrews passed away a year before filing the complaint. Guy Andrews passed away on October 22nd, 2012. The plaintiff filed his complaint on October 3rd, 2013. The plaintiff did not know that the defendant died at that time. The plaintiff found out that he died at Constance Andrews' hearing to dismiss on March 25th, 2014. We're here because of three issues today, and I'm asking the court to uphold justice for Mr. Carter and remand his case to the lower court so that he can pursue against the estate of Guy Andrews. The first issue is that defendant Guy Andrews was not named in the caption. However, the Ninth Circuit has held that even though a defendant is inadvertently omitted from the caption, if he's named in the body of a complaint and there's clear intent that he is deemed a defendant, then the case should not be dismissed. The Ninth Circuit has held that since 1988 in the Aceta v. Bima, as well as Rice v. Hamilton, which was held in 1983. A party may be properly in a case if the allegations in the body of the complaint make it plain that the party is intended as a defendant. Respondent only offers a case from the Seventh Circuit. We're in the Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit has jurisdiction. Here, although...
Well, I don't think they have jurisdiction. We're in the Ninth Circuit, but I don't think they have jurisdiction.
They are persuasive authority.
I would submit that so is the Seventh Circuit. I guess my problem with this issue is how do you get around the textual language? I don't know that the Ninth Circuit offers a very good reason for that. The Seventh Circuit says the rule textually says that the name of the defendant must be in the caption. I worry that it's misleading to the defense not to know who's a defendant and who isn't.
Well, Nevada is a notice pleading state, so you don't need those technicalities of just being named in the caption. Here in this complaint, Guy Andrews' name was identified in all capital letters, which is common practice when you're naming a defendant. As well, in the complaint, the general allegation, paragraph 5, stated Guy Andrews had permission to operate the Cadillac Escalade at the time of the accident.
But let me just pause you there, because I share Justice Hardesty's concern that Rule 10A says very explicitly about the caption, in the complaint, the title of the action shall include the name of all parties. And as a practical matter, you have a complaint and a summons is issued in the name of one of the named parties and that served on that party, they can look at that and see whether they're a party and they're cross-indexed in the court system as a party when they appear. So how do we get past the use of shall? Do we just say it means may or substantial compliance is enough? What's your argument to get past the text of the rule?
No, Your Honor. I think we should honor the rule. However, in this circumstance, when a defendant's name is just omitted from the caption, a complaint should not be dismissed when that defendant is named throughout the body of the complaint and there's clear intent that he was named a defendant. That's egregious to completely dismiss a case just because the defendant was not named within that caption. That's just a technical requirement.
But it could have been amended as of right. I agree with you.
Correct. And that's the purpose of amending a complaint.
Okay.
The complaint was amended once prior counsel discovered this error in January of 2014, but the lower court incorrectly held that that was beyond the statute of limitations, and they dismissed the case. And that's the issue with this. There was clear intent that he was deemed a defendant prior counsel.
So you're making a relation back argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Yes. Because there was clear intent to deem him as a defendant. And if Guy Andrews received the complaint, he had the duty to read through it, and he would have noticed that he was the operator of the vehicle and that he did, commit negligence per se, or those cause of actions were alleged against him.
Well, I read the complaint a couple of different times, and it does seem that the complaint maybe inartfully omits him from the caption, but artfully makes clear that Constance Andrews is referenced as the defendant and Mr. Andrews is referenced as Mr. Andrews. What would you offer to, in the specifics, let's just take negligence, the cause of action for negligence. How would Guy Andrews know that he's a defendant under that allegation?
Okay. Let's go to paragraph 5.
Okay.
That Guy Andrews had permission to operate the subject vehicle at the incident. Let's go to the first cause of action, negligence. Paragraph XVII, G. Andrews had a duty to operate, as the operator, the vehicle in a safe manner. Next paragraph, G. Andrews, in all caps, at the time of the accident, was negligent and careless in the operation of his vehicle in the following aspects. The next paragraph, in his failure, so not her, not mm-hmm. he failed to reasonably protect other drivers, and as a direct cause of that negligence, plaintiff was injured.
Right, but wouldn't those same allegations be made in a case in which you're suing a defendant for permissive use? This was a case, I think, that most readers would look at the complaint and say, you're making a claim against, I think it was the mother, for permissive use of the vehicle, not necessarily for the driver who caused the accident.
Well, the driver, as the operator, committed negligence by operating the vehicle in a reckless manner.
But in asserting a claim against the owner of the vehicle for permissive use, you'd need to make that allegation anyway. So I guess the problem I'm having is that you would have us interpret it as a separate claim when it could also just as equally be interpreted as an essential part of the claim against the permissive use defendant who was named in the caption.
Well, I think with reading the plain language of the negligence cause of action, I mean, they stated that he was the operator of the vehicle at the specific time of the accident, mm-hmm. and that Constance insured and owned the vehicle, which is different. So negligence is pled against the operator of the vehicle, and the negligence per se is also pled against Guyant.
So given the mandatory nature of the rule, the use of the word shall, as Justice Pickering pointed out, how far should we go if we buy your position that it's clear from the body of the complaint that Mr. Andrews was part of the cause of action, the several cause of actions? How far do we go Is it okay if a person is not named in the caption and they're named in one cause of action? Or, I mean, I think that the mandatory nature of the rule is to avoid this type of decision-making. Is it okay if he's named in the body or not? How far, if you're writing the decision and you win, how would you have us write it?
I'd have the rule state exactly the same, that you shall name the defendant in the caption.
And you lose.
However, but in interpreting that rule, if there's clear intent that the defendant was deemed to be a defendant and he's just only omitted from the caption due to that technicality, and there was amended complaint filed, in this instance, the case shouldn't be dismissed. That was extremely egregious. So I think in interpreting the rule, it's important that there are technical errors made and there's a way to remedy that situation besides just dismissing the case.
One of the things that maybe supports your point that the intent was to name Guy as a defendant was the initiation of service with the Department of Motor Vehicles. But there does appear to be a problem with service. You ask us to afford you substantial compliance recognition of service, but not sure how we can do that. I wondered if you could comment on that part of your argument.
Sure. Well, the plaintiff did attempt to serve Guy Andrews through personal service, but he couldn't, probably because Guy Andrews was deceased at the time. So he went to the next step and tried to serve through the DMV. He served a copy of the complaint, as well as the summons, paid the fee, and then the next step states to mail a copy through registered or certified mail to defendant's address stated on the police report, or the best available address to the plaintiff. There's no address on the police report because this was a hit-and-run accident.
Mm-hmm.
Plaintiff has no knowledge of the best-known address because the defendant, Guy Andrews, has been deceased for a year. So plaintiff did substantially comply with the statute. And in Globig v. 8th Judicial District Court, I know it was unpublished, but according to the new rule as of January 2016, unpublished opinions are persuasive. The court said substantial compliance with NRS 17.020 service of process is okay when justice permits. In this case, it's the plaintiff did all that he could to comply with service of process through the DMV. And it would be unjust to dismiss his case when he actually could not comply because...
But Globig had, first of all, the rule authorizes citation of unpublished dispositions that are filed on or after January 1, 2016. So Globig is not truly in play. But also Globig, the facts recited in that order say that they did mail by certified mail. They just did not have the certified mail receipt as part of the record. And in your case, only the first step of the service by publication was accomplished, which is to say delivery to DMV. I don't see any evidence at all of any kind of certified mailing. And while I appreciate your position that you were having trouble locating or your client was having trouble locating an address for Guy Andrews, that doesn't stop them from trying to find a last known address and so on and so forth. The record is just a void there. So even if I credit your position that substantial compliance should be good enough under the DMV service, I'm troubled both legally and from a due process standpoint with saying it's good enough when you don't even attempt certified mail in addition directed to the named defendant. I think there's U.S. Supreme Court authority on the limits of service by publication in this arena. Could you comment on that?
Sure. In this instance, plaintiff thought he did substantially comply by serving a copy at the DMV. He did make attempts to find the address, and in this rare instance, the defendant, it was a hit-and-run accident.
Where does it show that he attempted to find the address?
That prior counsel did that. I don't have knowledge of that, but there's an affidavit from prior counsel saying that she did make attempts to personally serve as well as find the address of Guy Andrews.
Does that affidavit say that she attempted to locate an address and couldn't find one?
I am unsure of that. but she did say she made diligent efforts to locate the address and couldn't.
And did she move for an extension of time to accomplish service, given those difficulties?
No, she did not.
So you would ask us to find substantial compliance with respect to the naming of the defendant, proper defendant, from the caption. You would ask us to give you a walk with respect, not you, but those who actually effectuated the service, a little bit of a walk with respect to not completely complying with the rule in order, and I get it. I get the justice part of it. But you're asking us to sort of be, for lack of a better term, squishy on a whole bunch of rules as we go through this analysis. And I think we all have concerns about that.
It is what's fair. And when, you know, this court should do what's fair, and in this instance, it was a hit and run. The defendant died, and it would be fair to remand this to the lower court so that the plaintiff could go against the estate of Guy Andrews. And therefore, this should be remanded, so that's possible.
We asked you a number of questions, so we'll give you the 2 minutes. You're just about out of time, but we'll put 2 minutes on the clock for your rebuttal and ask Mr. Shannon to make his remarks. He'll have 17 minutes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Your Honors, I please the court. We have multiple issues, obviously. We have multiple issues in play here. I don't think that you can look at one of these issues in a vacuum. I think that so many of them interplay with one another. We've got they're building blocks here of procedural deficiencies, and touched on some of them in the earlier argument. I want to run through some of these.
Start with the first one.
First one.
Why should this court follow the reasoning of the Seventh Circuit when the Ninth Circuit seems to have a fairly lengthy history of permitting defendants to be named or identified in the body of the complaint rather than the caption?
Well, okay, if I'd start with the rule. I mean, Rule 10 of the Rules of Civil Procedure is stated in mandatory terms that the title of the complaint shall include the names of all of the parties. That's mandatory language. Now, I know we have Miles in there from the Seventh Circuit, and I think it raises a good point. How do you defend yourself if you don't even know that you're a defendant? Now, to your point, Your Honor, there is some case law, and it was cited in their brief from the Ninth Circuit and from elsewhere that talks about, you know, if we have somebody who's in the body of the complaint and based on the content of the complaint, that person can glean that the, you know, they were supposed to be named as a defendant.
Well, in fairness to appellant, it isn't just the Ninth Circuit. It seems to be a prevailing view in the federal circuits, period.
Well,
except
for
the Seventh.
I saw one from Minnesota. I saw one from Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. There are a few.
Are you aware of any circuit other than the Seventh Circuit that has taken the hardline approach that if it's not named in the caption, it's over?
I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not. I know we don't have a lot. I personally didn't find a lot of law on it one way or the other, frankly. But I think if you look at the cases that are cited in the appellant's brief, I mean, these are all very fact-specific. These are very, very case-specific analyses that are going on. I mean, to you know, use an example, the Springwater Dairy case from Minnesota. I mean, here we have an individual who sued and actually got served. He got served with process. He wasn't in the caption, but the court found that, okay, since he was actually served, he should have gleaned from that he was supposed to be a defendant in the case. So they gave him a pass on that, for lack of a better word. Here, we don't have service. Of course, that's one of the issues here. It's one of the building blocks, if you will. We don't have service. The Brown case, you know, from Pennsylvania, pro se plaintiff. The court had kind of a relaxed standard in that particular case because this individual was proceeding pro se. This individual here, Mr. Carter, wasn't pro se. He had an attorney who was supposed to be going through these procedural steps. So I think it is distinguishable. And what I would say is even if you want to dispense with the mandatory language of Rule 10, if you want to get rid of the fact that this says you shall put them in the complaint and just look at the body of this complaint itself, what you have is a complaint that doesn't once, not once, in the body of that complaint identify Guy Andrews as a defendant. Not once. I mean, he's named in there all the time, but what you see throughout the body of the complaint is Constance Andrews, named as the defendant, Guy Andrews, never once named as the defendant. I mean, to give you a good example, paragraph 29 says, Guy Andrews failed to operate the defendant's vehicle in a safe manner. Okay? He failed to operate
the defendant's. Well, the complaint begins to look like it's a claim against the permissive.
Well, I was going to say, the way I read this, looking at it, is that they found out that Constance Andrews is the one who has the insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So they went ahead and sued her, and granted, they defined some negligent conduct on the part of Guy Andrews, but they didn't choose to sue him because they know she's got the insurance. So the theory being, the way I read the complaint, that you've got a permissive user vicarious liability situation going on here, so we're going to name Constance Andrews, we're not going to name Guy Andrews. That's the way I read the complaint. And I, if you look at the body of the complaint, you want to dispense with Rule 10. I don't see that he's ever been identified in that complaint really as a defendant. Certainly it's not plain that he was supposed to be in the case.
When was the summons issued as to him, do you know, in his name?
I know that it was served on the DMV on the 31st, I believe, January 31st, 2014.
And the complaint was filed?
Well, the first complaint was filed October 3rd of 2013.
Okay.
That, as far as I know, there was no effort made at serving that complaint. I haven't seen anything in the record to suggest as much. The amended complaint, it looks like it was filed on January 27th of 2014, served on the DMV January 31st of 2014, it appears.
So the record, so far as you know, and I appreciate that you may not have it at your fingertips, does not contain a summons issued as to the original complaint in the name of the male Andrews.
Guy Andrews.
Guy Andrews.
Correct.
Okay.
I have not seen anything to suggest as much, Your Honor. And I do want to talk about relation back for a minute. I know that came up very briefly in the earlier argument. The amended complaint is barred by the statute of limitations. The date of the accident's October 13, 2011. You got 2 years from that date. It's the fact of the accident, the fact of having alleged injuries from that accident, that provides the notice to the plaintiff to go ahead and file his lawsuit, get everybody served appropriately. I want to talk about this idea of concealment for a minute. And I say this with the caveat that all of the information we have about what happened at the accident scene has come from Mr. Carter. I mean, the unfortunate reality of the case is that my client, Guy Andrews, he's passed away. So we don't get his version of the facts. But Mr. Carter's affidavit, if you look at it, if you look at the admissions in here's what we know. There's the accident. They both get out of their vehicles. They converse. We know all this. And Mr. Carter has enough time to actually take pictures of Mr. Andrews' license plate. He gets the license plate. He gets the license plate number. Okay, so he has the information he needs. I know there's a contention that our guy sped away at some point in time, but this isn't just a hit and run where there's the impact and he's off. And there is a dialogue that goes on at the accident scene. Now, as early as April of 2012, Mr. Carter, by his own admission, is aware of the identity of the alleged wrongdoers here. Okay, so he at that point still has 16 months. He still has 16 months within the statute of limitations framework to do whatever he needs to do to get his complaint on file. And he does. He files that initial complaint within the two-year time frame. He just doesn't have Guy Andrews listed as a defendant in there. So now what we have is this initial complaint filed within the statute with no Guy Andrews, and then several months later we get the second amended complaint, or the first amended complaint, I'm sorry. No relation back. And here's why. Nuremberger factors. And the one factor that is absolutely critical to the analysis here is the reasonable diligence. Reasonable diligence to ascertain the true identity of the intended defendant to have that amended complaint relate back. By his own admission, Mr. Carter knew of Guy Andrews 16 months before he filed his initial complaint, much less the amended complaint. He knew the identity, and he didn't need to ascertain his identity. He already had it at the time that the first complaint was filed. I think that's very telling. And then he waits, you know, another 4 months to amend the complaint. And I think that begs the question here, is that if you felt like the original complaint was sufficient to identify Guy Andrews as a defendant, why amend the complaint? Why is that necessary? But I digress. I mean, it's a building blocks analogy again. Multiple problems here. Nuremberger, that reasonable diligence analysis in Nuremberger contemplates not knowing who the defendant is at the time you file your initial complaint. That's why we have Doe and Roe pleadings. You don't know who it is. You go ahead and you file within the statute, and then you amend. And then hopefully it relates back. Well, here, you didn't need to go find out who the defendant was. You knew. You knew before you even filed the first complaint. I mean, it's Nuremberger on steroids. I mean, we already know who the person is. You don't even have to go find him. On the issue of service.
If we agree with you on service, we don't reach the 10A issue, correct?
Yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, if service is insufficient, I don't know that we even need to go into whether he was properly identified as a defendant or not. I mean, the bottom line here is that there is no evidence in the record that there was even an attempt made to serve process on Mr. Andrews. Not even an attempt.
Well, there was. I mean, they delivered it to the DMV.
There's the DMV. But
counsel
but
makes that point, and that's the record.
I don't dispute that. I don't dispute that. What I dispute is that there's another step you have to go through, and I would argue that the rule 14070 is clear. I mean, yeah, you got to go serve the DMV, but then you've got to mail that a copy of the complaint, copy of the summons to the defendant, to the intended defendant at his last known address.
Ms. Goldberg referred to prior counsel's affidavit on this issue. What's your view of that affidavit?
I think it's pretty bare bones, to be honest. I know that it said, yeah, we engaged in due diligence in trying to find this individual. There's
it
no
doesn't articulate any specifics.
There's nothing. There's nothing specific as far as what they did in trying to locate Mr. Andrews for the purposes of serving process on him. I have no idea what they did. What I know is that there's no evidence that the summons and complaint were actually mailed to him as required by the rule. And the rule's mandatory. I mean, it's May. You know, we talked about in the briefing here the distinction between subsection 2 and subsection 3 of the statute. You know, subsection 3 allows the court some flexibility to preserve the rights of the defendant, not the plaintiff, but the defendant, to adequately defend an action. There's no such flexibility in subsection 2.
Am I correct that the license of the vehicle showed Constance Andrews as the owner or the registered owner of the vehicle, that Guy's name was not on that?
Correct. She is the registered owner. She was the insured, the person who was insured for that vehicle. Mm-hmm. That's correct, Your Honor.
So at least having the driver's, or excuse me, having the vehicle license wouldn't necessarily provide the plaintiff with the address for Guy Andrews.
Well, I would agree with that, but it gives you a starting point to actually do your due diligence and find him.
Did you know the mother's name and the son's name?
Well, okay, Mr. Carter knows this wasn't a woman driving the car that hit him. I mean, they got out and they spoke.
And by the time the complaint's filed, he knows the guy's name.
Right. So, I mean, he figures out who it was that's actually driving the vehicle. Mm. I mean, it's there in the complaint. He's aware. He's aware who the driver was. So I take issue with the idea that this guy was hard to find. These days, I mean, it's not, at least my experience, is not too hard to find anybody, really. I mean, if you need to get a private investigator to go down to Texas to find him, that's what you do. At least to get an address where you can comply with 14070. And that didn't happen. So, you know, you're supposed to mail a copy of the summons and complaint, provide the affidavit of compliance, and file that with the court. And there's nothing, you know, I know that there's an argument here about the statute being ambiguous. I don't find anything ambiguous about that statute. It enumerates exactly what things you have to do if you're trying to effect service through the DMV. And here, again, there's no evidence of any effort having been made to place Guy Andrews on notice of the litigation. And, you know, the Globig case, you know, for what it's worth, I know that this isn't technically citable at this point in time, but I do want to just point out that in that particular case, there wasn't a a receipt filed. There wasn't an affidavit of service filed. But the plaintiff in that case was able to provide the court other evidence that they had at least mailed the summons and complaint to the intended defendant and you know, let him slide on that. Here, there's no evidence of that, none at all. There's no evidence of any attempt whatsoever. So when the appellant talks about there being substantial compliance with NRS 14070 and that it was sufficient to avoid a harsh, unfair, absurd consequence, what I point out is it's missing the boat. There is no legal authority. There's none cited in their brief. There's none that I'm aware of that says substantial compliance with 14070 is sufficient. I'm aware of no authority to that effect. You have to comply with every part of that rule. It's how the rule is written. You shall do these certain things. Serve the DMV, mail the summons and complaint to the intended defendant, the last known address, provide that affidavit of compliance. None of that happened here.
And just to confirm, there was no motion to extend time to effectuate service either, is that
fair? I was just going to mention that, Your Honor. Yeah, that there's an argument in the briefing that there should have been, you know, a Rule 4I extension of time beyond the 120 days. There was no motion to that effect.
And 4I. And our rule says, unlike the federal rule, that thou shalt file a motion.
Yeah, I mean, that rule is written in mandatory language as well. If you want that extension beyond the 120 days, not only do you have to file the motion, but you have to show good cause for why you weren't able to effect service within the initial 120 days. And the motion was never made, and to this point, we haven't seen any argument, either at the lower court or in the briefing before this court, arguing that there was good cause for that failure to effect service. So, you know.
If they had issued summons to Guy Andrews when they filed the original complaint as written, and if they had served that on him in compliance with the 14070 and had some address, they'd found his last known address, would you accept that that was acceptable under Rule 10, or do you still argue that we should adopt the Seventh Circuit position and say, look, let's not confuse things?
The latter.
Okay.
I mean, I think if it had happened that way, hypothetically,
it'd be a much stronger case.
I'd say slightly stronger, because then I think you take the service issue out of the equation. Now you've effected proper service. But if you've effected proper service...
And by trying to make service and issuing the summons at the time you filed it, you support the argument you really meant to name him, and it's a clerical oversight in the caption structure.
Right. But if I'm Guy Andrews and I've been served with these papers, I don't see my name listed as a defendant, and I think, what am I supposed to do with this?
And more, we have so many cases that say shall means shall. It's mandatory.
Right.
Yeah.
Just to kind of wrap up here, I seem kind of out of time. Again, the claim is barred by the statute of limitations. The relation back is a non-starter from my perspective. It's clear that there wasn't reasonable diligence here. They knew who the driver was before they filed the first complaint. There's no effort made to identify Mr. Andrews or his circumstances.
Counsel, I know this is a digression from the point of the appeal, which is focused on Guy Andrews, but is there a reason why Constance Andrews is in the caption of this appeal?
I don't know why she would be in there. She's not in the case anymore.
She was dismissed out for lack of service, right?
She was, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
For lack of jurisdiction, I believe. Or was she served?
It was a lack of jurisdiction,
and
failure to state a claim is my understanding of why she was dismissed.
Under DAGRA. But so there's no reason that her name should appear in the caption.
It should not be in the caption.
All right.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Shannon. Ms. Goldberg, anything you'd like to add?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you agree with your colleague that the caption of the appeal should be modified to strike Constance Andrews from it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
This case boiled down to doing what's fair. I'm going to talk about the service of process. Plaintiff did substantially comply. The statute states plain language that you need to mail the copy of the process of service
to the defendant's address in the police report, or if there's none, the best available address to the plaintiff. The plaintiff had no best available address because the defendant had been deceased for almost a year before the complaint was filed. So, plaintiff substantially complied with DMV service of process. This court stated in Levin v. Fry that in determining whether strict or substantial compliance is required, courts examine policy and equity considerations. And the court should look to fairness in this and should not dismiss this case when it was impossible to comply with DMV service of process because there was no address available to the plaintiff. With that being said, the court should look to whether the case was properly dismissed because the defendant wasn't named in the caption. Ninth Circuit is clear that that is not grounds for dismissing a complaint. When the defendant is named in the body of the complaint, identified, and in this case, that's what happened here. Negligence, as well as negligence per se, were pled against Guy Andrews. The respondent just cites one case from the Seventh Circuit, and the facts are different on that because the defendants weren't identified throughout the body of the complaint. In this instant, Guy Andrews was identified in pretty much every paragraph of the complaint. So this court should hold with the Ninth Circuit and deem that Guy Andrews was a defendant in this case and allow Mr. Carter to proceed against the estate of Guy Andrews in the lower court, and that would be fair. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Goldberg, Mr. Shannon, thank you for your arguments here today and your briefs. This case will stand submitted.